The Holy Prophet of Islam says, I have been sent to complete noble manners.
A'udhu billahi min shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Dear brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome to For a Better Life with me, Javed Akbari. In this episode, we are going to focus a little bit on the good attributes of human beings, those qualities which Allah has bestowed upon men and through which human beings have been made superior to other creatures. Obviously, we understand that mankind is superior to all other creatures of Allah because of the qualities and the attributes that he has been gifted with. Now, there are many attributes of human beings and many verses about them. Of course, if you want to find some Quranic proofs, some Quranic verses, I will mention some of the verses about those qualities, those important attributes that man has and man enjoys. The human being is the vicegerent of Allah on this planet Earth. That's for sure. The Holy Quran says, "Inni ja'ilun fil ardi khalifa." And of course, you can go to verse 30 of chapter 2 of chapter Al-Baqarah, where the Quran says, "And when your Lord said to the angels, I am going to place on earth a vicegerent, inni ja'ilun fil ardi khalifa." So this means that man is God's vicegerent on earth. Now, this is not the only verse, and of course, there are other verses in the Quran. The Quran says, in chapter 6, verse 135, "And he is who has made you successors in the land and raised some of you above others by various grades, and he might try you by what he has given you." So this is another verse, and I'm just trying to suffice through the translation of the verse for the sake of brevity. Now, of course, in some cases, I will touch on the verse itself as well. Human beings have been actually blessed with the capacity of knowledge. The holy verse of the Quran says, وَعَلَّمَ آدَمَ الْأَسْمَاءَ كُلَّهَا ثُمَّ عَرَضَهُمْ عَلَى الْمَلَائِكَةِ فَقَالَ أَنْبِئُونِي بِأَسْمَاءِ هَؤُلَاءِ إِن كُنْتُمْ صَادِقِينَ. And he taught Adam all the names, then presented them to the angels. Then he said, "Tell me the names of those if you are right." This is one of the verses of the Quran, which, of course, clearly suggests man's superiority over other creatures, including the angels, including the jinns. And of course, you know that based on this verse, the Quran says, وَعَلَّمَ آدَمَ الْأَسْمَاءَ كُلَّهَا. God taught Adam all the names, all the attributes, you know. And then, of course, the same names were presented to the angels, and the angels were unable to mention them or to say anything because the angels did not have the capacity to learn and did not have the ability to memorize the names. Of course, when it comes to what the names are, this has to be studied in the context of the ayat, and of course, we have to refer to the exegesis or the commentary of the whole Quran to understand what those names are. That is a secret, probably. Names in this verse, according to some scholars and according to some exegetes, means realities. Not only names of people or things or items, you know. That's for sure. Because it's very easy to learn names. But when it comes to the secrets or realities of things, that's an uphill task, you know. That's not something easy to learn. And that's why the angels, the malaika, were unable to learn those names. Let's have a break. We will be back.
We changed the desert into oases. We built buildings of different lengths and sizes, and we felt so very satisfied. We bought and bought and couldn't stop buying. We gave charity to the poor cause we couldn't stand the crying. We thought we paid our dues, but in fact, to ourselves we're just lying. Oh, I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. Is it satisfied? Is Allah satisfied? Is Allah satisfied?
Dear brothers and sisters, when angels thought that they were superior to Adam, Allah the Most Glorious wanted to prove that the angels were wrong. The Almighty God taught Adam all the facts and then asked the angels if they were true in their claim of being superior to man. Then they would have to divulge those facts and secrets to Allah. You know, if they were true in their claim that they were actually superior, they should have divulge those facts and secrets to Allah. But, you know, according to the Quran, they were not able to do so. And so we can understand from this verse that man is capable of attaining all knowledge. Man has the capacity to improve and to make progress and to ascend and to elevate, you know, to move up to the heavens and to get as close to Allah through attaining knowledge, through attaining perfection, and through learning the, you know, attributes. Human beings are created in such a way that they can know their creator through, you know, innate knowledge. Man has no need to use external ways for knowing Allah. If you go deep into our spirits, we can understand that we are created, that we have a Lord, and that we have been created for a purpose. If provided that the instinct, that the fitrah that God has bestowed or that God has placed in us is not overwhelmed by anything else. I give you an example which has been reported from Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq alayhi salatu wasalam. A man actually went to Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq alayhi salatu wasalam and asked him to prove the existence of Allah, the Most Glorious. The Imam asked him whether he had traveled on a ship or not. The man answered in the affirmative. He said, yes, I have traveled. Then the Imam asked him whether in his travel, in his journey, or in his voyage, a situation arose where there existed a danger for the ship to sink, and that people began to panic and were afraid that the ship would be wrecked and they would die as a result. The man again gave an affirmative answer. He said, yes, of course. The Imam then asked, did you think of any power that could have saved you then? The man said, yes. Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq alayhi salatu wasalam concluded, that's Allah, the Omnipotent. You thought of Allah, that's Allah, the Omnipotent. And of course, in miseries and in the state of absolute helplessness, we remember the absolute being who is Allah. We have experienced, every one of us has experienced this situation, this particular situation, when we are in absolute misery, we remember Allah, we remember that supreme being, and we pray to Him to help us. And that means that God has given us the fitrah, that feeling, you know, that when we are in danger, we feel no one can help us other than Allah. And that is the inborn knowledge. In fact, the inborn knowledge is awakened. It is activated. And of course, in many, you know, people and in ordinary situations, this knowledge of Allah, you know, is dormant. Normally, you know, we don't care about it. It is dormant. It's not very much active. But it can be awakened and strengthened, especially when we lose our, for example, shelter, and when we lose our strength and feel quite helpless. There are brothers and sisters, there are more to say in this regard, but I will suffice to this much. And of course, there are verses. Inshallah, we will cover this topic in the following episode. Until then, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
every grain of sand
in every desert land.
He knows every shade of palm,
every closed hand.
He knows every sparkling tear
on every eyelash.
He knows every thought I have
and every word I share.
He knows.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The Central Intelligence Agency has secretly been running mass surveillance operations to collect data on Americans, according to a newly published letter written by Senators Ron Wyden and Martin Heinrich. Stay with us for an article in this regard, written by John Miltimore Ryder. This article is published under the heading, Six Things We Know About the CIA's Secret Mass Surveillance Program. Here's the story. The Central Intelligence Agency has secretly been running mass surveillance operations to collect data on Americans, according to a newly published letter written by Senators Ron Wyden and Martin Heinrich. Wyden and Heinrich, both members of the Senate Intelligence Committee, wrote the letter in April 2021, and the letter was partly declassified recently. In the letter, Wyden and Heinrich called on the CIA to inform the public about the data collection program, calling for full transparency. This declassification is urgent, the senators wrote. The CIA responded to the allegations in a statement published by the Wall Street Journal. CIA recognizes and takes very seriously our obligation to respect the privacy and civil liberties of U.S. persons in the conduct of our vital national security mission and conducts our activities, including collection activities, in compliance with U.S. law, Executive Order 12,333, and our Attorney General guidelines, said Christy Scott, the agency's privacy and civil liberties officer, adding, CIA is committed to transparency consistent with obligation to protect intelligence sources and methods. The allegations from Wyden and Heinrich are serious, but the extent of the danger and severity is clouded by several factors, not the least of which is the fact that the letter is highly redacted. Here are a few important takeaways. Number one, laws prohibit CIA spying on Americans. As Politico noted, the CIA is largely prohibited by law from engaging in domestic spying, which makes the revelations troubling. But as the Wall Street Journal reports, at times intelligence agencies have found ways to circumvent these prohibitions, noting that some U.S. intelligence programs collect broad streams of internet or telephone data in a way that can scoop up information on Americans, such as when someone is communicating with a target of surveillance who lives overseas. This is known as incidental collection, and it's an issue lawmakers in both parties have flagged as a violation of civil liberties and personal privacy. Number two, the nature of the surveillance is unclear. Several publications have pointed out that the nature of the surveillance isn't really clear. Yet the language in the redacted letter suggests the program involves non-traditional surveillance, noting data collection is done in bulk and uses backdoor searches of Americans, the same issue that has generated bipartisan concern in the FISA context. As the ACLU says, this implies the spy agency may be vacuuming up vast amounts of information to spy on Americans and storing it indefinitely. Number three, the surveillance is warrantless. While the nature of the surveillance is murky, Senators Wyden and Heinrich make one thing clear. The information being collected is warrantless, meaning the data are being scooped up without a warrant. This directly violates the Fourth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, which states the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures, shall not be violated, and no warrants shall issue, but upon probable cause, supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized. And number four, the program appears to be unlawful. While what constitutes spying is debatable, but Wyden and Heinrich suggest that the program may have exceeded its lawful bounds. While the senators don't use the words unlawful or illegal, they suggest the program may be just that, noting it falls entirely outside the statutory framework that Congress and the public believe govern this collection. What the precise statutory framework isn't spelled out here, but it's safe to say that Wyden believes that the CIA is acting outside that of a scope. Number 5. The CIA is acting without oversight. While there has been a great deal of discussion on the idea that the FBI's FISA warrant process is broken, it's worth noting that at least that program had some judicial oversight, weak as it often was. Wyden and Heinrich suggest this is not the case with CIA's data collection program, which they say operates without any of the judicial, congressional, or even executive branch oversight that comes from the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. At number 6, this isn't Wyden's first dust-up with CIA. Finally, it's worth noting that this is not the first time Wyden has clashed with the CIA over rogue operations. In 2016, the senator from Oregon had a heated exchange with then-CIA Director John Brennan over the CIA's improper search of Senate files, including the unauthorized search of the emails of Senate staffers investigating the CIA's use of torture in the so-called War on Terror. Brennan denied the CIA's actions were improper, even though both a CIA Inspector General and a review board appointed by Brennan himself conceded the search resulted in an appropriate access to the Senate's work product, prompting a sharp rebuke from Wyden. In 2013, Wyden also asked Director of National Intelligence James Clapper if the NSA collected any type of data at all on millions or hundreds of millions of Americans. Clapper responded, "No, sir, not wittingly." It was later revealed the NSA was in fact collecting metadata on millions of law-abiding Americans without warrants. Many thinkers have written about the dangers of bureaucracy, a system in which important decisions are made not only by individuals or even elected representatives, but state officials. The famed writer and traveler Alexei D. Togavey saw bureaucracy as the Achilles heel of modern democracy. A century later, the great economist Ludwig von Mises wrote an entire book about its nature and evils, bureaucracy. The tentacles of the U.S. bureaucratic state do not reach as far as those of states in the 20th century, the period in which Arendt wrote, but as early as the 1930s, government reports have warned about a headless fourth branch of the government responsible to no one. That was more than 80 years ago. Now, there is a secret CIA program that has been spying on Americans free from any kind of oversight for an undetermined length of time. This sounds just a bit like the terror Arendt described. What happens next, however, is unclear. The list of U.S. intelligence scandals and improper programs has grown lengthy in recent years, but accountability has been elusive. We will see if this time is any different.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, loss of authority of parents over training kids. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's topic, we will talk about the loss of the authority of parents over kids when they are training them, especially when they need to train them according to the Islamic teachings. In the Islamic lifestyle and in the Islamic teachings, we can see that the parents are made the authority over their kids. The parents have authority over their kids. And they are the core of the family. And the whole family should gather around the father, especially because he is the guardian and he is the wali of the family. And it is also said in the narrations that the children must listen to their father and mother. And we have a lot of supplications in the Quran, the Quranic supplications, in which it is there are praise for the parents, and especially, and also about, it is said to the parents to pray for their generations, not just the kids that they have, but even the generations, so that the generations should be on the right path. So there are many people, and the prophets, they used to pray for their children and the generations. And therefore we can see in such family, the core of the family and the authority of the family, the authority is in the hands of the parents, and the kids cannot do whatever they want. Therefore, it is very easy for such parents to train their kids according to the Islamic teachings. And this is what Islam says. Therefore, we need to pay attention to this issue that when we are the parents, therefore, we have the authority and we should use it in the best way, in the proper way, not forcing the kids in the mean that they get disheartened, but to deal with them at the right time, at the right age, inshallah. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the loss of authority of parents over training kids. In today's world, we see that we have parents at home who are named as parents or mother and father because obviously they are the parents, but they do not have any authority in the house. They do not have the importance in the house as they should have. Rather, we see that the television, the internet, the mobile phone, the tablets, the video games, the school friends, I don't know. There are many, many other things which are the main source of the training kids, and the father and the mother are not paying attention towards these things, and they're not performing their obligation. They're not performing their job. Their job was to train kids. Their job was to train good people and give good people to the society. And now because they left them on their own with the mobile phones, with the internet, with the rest of things, with the movies, songs, and there are many other things, therefore we can see that the ethics of the children has become the way they see in the videos, they see in the movies, they see in the video games, especially these insane video games where we have, for example, like guns, killings, robbing, and all kinds of things. And even in today's world, in the movies, the robbers are the heroes and the cops and the police are the villain. In such an environment where everything is opposing the right path and the which is overruling the policies and the laws of a country, there we have left our kids on their own. And this causes the loss of authority of parents over their kids when they want to train them. Therefore, Islam is against such thing. Islam emphasizes on the parents that you must become the authority. You are the authority. Islam has given you the authority, and therefore you need to train your kids. You need to teach them the best ethics. You need to teach them the Quranic you need to teach them the Quran and the Quranic studies. So it is on the shoulders of the parents, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/en/call-of-islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
In the limelight.
A new report reveals U.S. military academies remain inundated by institutional racism despite minor gains since proclaiming anti-discrimination policies a decade ago to bring in more racially diverse students. Here we present you an article in this regard written jointly by our own Morrison, Helen Wiffering, and Noreen Nasir, titled Report Says U.S. Military Academies Remain Plagued by Racism. Stay tuned for more. According to an AP report, 8 years after he graduated from the U.S. Military Academy at West Point, African-American Jeffrey Easterling remains astonished by the Confederate history still memorialized on the storied academy's campus. The 6-foot-tall painting of Confederate Gen. Robert E. Lee in the library, the barracks dormitory named for Lee, and the Lee Gate on Lee Road. He remembers feeling devastated as a black student at the Army Academy when a classmate pointed out that the slave also depicted in the Lee painting. He recalls thinking, as quoted in the report, how did the only black person who got on a wall in this entire humans school, how is it a slave? Sterling later traveled the country as a diversity admissions officer to recruit the students from underrepresented communities to West Point and observed, it was so hard to tell people like, yeah, you can trust the military. And then their kids Google and go, why is there a barracks named after Lee? According to the report, American military academies provide a key pipeline into the leadership of the armed services, and for the better part of the last decade, they have welcomed more racially diverse students each year. However, beyond blanket anti-discrimination policies, these federally funded institutions offer little details about how they screen for extremist or hateful behavior or address the racial slights that some graduates of color say they face daily. Earlier this year, AP published another report in which current and former enlistees and officers in nearly every branch of the armed services described a deep-rooted culture of racism and discrimination that stubbornly festers despite repeated efforts to eradicate it. Less attention has been paid to the premier institutions that produce a significant portion of the services officer corps. The academies of the U.S. Army and the U.S. Navy, the U.S. Air Force, the U.S. Coast Guard, and U.S. Merchant Marine. According to the report, some graduates of color from top U.S. military schools who endured What they describe as a hostile environment are left questioning the military maxim that all service members wearing the same uniform are equal. That includes Carlton Shelley II, who was recruited to play football for West Point from his Sarasota, Florida high school and entered the academy in 2009. On the field, he described the term as a brotherhood where his skin color didn't matter. But off the field, he said he and other black classmates too often were treated like stereotype of the angry black man. Some students of color have spotlighted what they see as a systematic discrimination at the academies by creating Instagram accounts, Black at West Point, Black at USAFA, and Black at USNA, to relate their personal experiences. The latest annual defense spending bill mandated that the Defense Department survey all its military properties for references or symbols that potentially commemorate the Confederacy, including at West Point, which the commission overseeing the work picked as its first site to visit earlier this year. But the deadline to act on any recommendations is still more than 2 years away. Following the murder of George Floyd in 2020, which sparked global protest, a group of West Point alums released a 40-page letter urging the academy to address major failures in combating intolerance and racism, adding, "We hold fast to the hope that our alma mater will take the necessary steps to champion the values it espouses." Shelley said the academy has significant work to do to retain and support the students of color. He said in his class, he estimated about 35 black students graduated, some crazy low number, adding, "And we started with a lot of more." Citing 2019 data from the Under Secretary of Defense, the report notes the academies are a growing pathway to officer status for black cadets, with about 13% of black active duty officers commissioned through the five institutions compared to 19% of white active duty officers. Most students who enroll, nearly 60 to 70%, are nominated by U.S. senators or representatives from their home states as part of a system created in 1840s to build a geographically diverse officer corps. However, today the country's changed demographics mean the system gives disproportionate influence to rural congressional districts that tend to be whiter. According to a March report by the Connecticut Veterans Legal Center, only 6% of nominations to the Army, Air Force, and Naval Academies made by the current members of Congress went to black candidates, even though 15% of the population aged 18 to 24 is black. The report said 8% of congressional nominations went to Hispanic students, though they make up 22% of young adults. The diversity of nominations has improved slightly in the past 25 years, but the report noted that 49 Congress members did not nominate a single black student while in office and 31 nominated no Hispanic candidates. While the number of Hispanic cadets increased in the past two decades at the Coast Guard and Naval Academies, black cadets showed no noticeable increase during that time. In the class of 2000, there were 73 black midshipmen in Naval Academy and just 77 in 2020. At the Coast Guard Academy, there were 15 black cadets in the 2001 class, and in 2021, merely 16. Two of the five academies, West Point and the Air Force Academy, now have their first black leaders. But Sterling, the West Point graduate, noted that the faculty there remains mostly white, meaning students who don't see themselves and don't want to stay can find it hard to ask for help. Greg Elliott said he often found himself in trouble as a midshipman at the Merchant Marine Academy and was asked to leave without graduating. He doesn't blame the academy for his mistakes, and he said he never faced overt racism, but he wonders if a more diverse faculty and student body could have changed his course by making him feel he belonged. He remembers a fellow black alum telling him to just plow through with his head down and realize the academy was a terrible place to be at, but it's a great place to be from. Both Sterling and Shelley said they also saw signs of extremism during their time in the army. Timothy Berry, a former Army field artillery officer who graduated from West Point in 2013 and served as class president, said he never felt comfortable reporting racist incidents while at the academy, fearing it would draw unwanted scrutiny to him not being a perfect cadet, however minor his shortcomings might be. An Inspector General's report last year found the Coast Guard Academy had mishandled nearly a dozen race-based harassment charges between 2013 and 2018, and also noted that harassment was underreported in part because of concerns about negative consequences. Lieutenant Commander Kimberly Young McClear, a black woman who taught at the academy from 2014 to 2019, said she herself faced years of harassment and retaliation on campus, which she had detailed in congressional testimony. Although the academies play a big role in the diversity of military leadership, some have argued that the pipeline begins even earlier. At the high school level, the Department of Defense sponsors junior ROTC programs at high schools around the country where students can learn the values of the armed services, run drills, and wear the uniforms. According to a 2017 study sponsored by the Secretary of Defense, the programs are often located at high schools with larger than average populations of students of color. Though it may not be an official recruitment program, junior ROTC promotes the military branches as a pathway to excellence. Cadets' handbooks for Navy, Army, Air Force, and Marine Corps all stipulate non-discrimination policies with regard to race and gender and emphasize treating everyone with dignity and respect. But former junior ROTC instructor Cardell Anthony Hopkins said little was done after one of his students at Lake Brantley High School in Florida alerted him to social media posts by her fellow cadets making racist comments about Hopkins, a retired black master sergeant.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of the speech delivered on June 3, 2016 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the occasion of 27th anniversary of Imam Khomeini's passing. The speech was delivered at Imam Khomeini's shrine in Tehran, Iran.
There are specific criteria for being a revolutionary. As I said, the third criterion is a commitment to independence. Independence is very important. It includes domestic, regional, global, and international independence. We should preserve the independence of the country and the system in all these areas. This means that we should not be deceived in the area of politics. An enemy whose goal is to make governments and nations follow him tries different methods. It is not the case that he always speaks in a threatening tone. Sometimes he flatters you, and sometimes he writes a letter saying that we should go and cooperate with the Americans so that together we can resolve global matters. He speaks to you in this manner, a manner of manipulation. You might be tempted to go and cooperate with a superpower so that you can resolve an international matter. This is how they speak in the discourse of formal and diplomatic correspondence. But this is not the truth of the matter.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The truth of the matter is that he has a plan in mind. He says that you should go and play on the pitch that he has drawn up. And it is the enemy who says how you should play. He says that you should carry out a certain task. Therefore, the ultimate goal for which a plan has been formulated becomes a reality. This is the reason why we did not agree to join the so-called American coalition on regional issues. On Syrian and quasi-Syrian issues, despite the fact that they had repeatedly asked us to do so, they have a plan, and they have portrayed certain goals which they hope to attain. Unquestionably, they are willing to benefit from the power, energy, and influence of every country, including the Islamic Republic. If the Islamic Republic is deceived and enters their ballpark, this means that it has filled in their work table. It means that it has completed their plan. This is against independence. Ostensibly, this is not like a situation when a government or a person comes and rules over the country, to the point that we say the independence of the country is gone. However, this approach is against political independence.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alami, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
In what seems to be a hefty catch, the Lebanese internal security forces
have thwarted a plan by Daesh terrorists to carry out 3 suicide bombings targeting religious compounds in Beirut's southern suburbs. Interior Minister Bassam al-Maulawi told reporters that had this terrorist plot not been stopped, it would have taken Lebanon to a very dangerous situation.
A Takfiri terrorist group recruited young Palestinian men in Lebanon to carry out major bombing attacks using explosive belts and using explosives which contain rocket missiles.
Lebanon's internal security forces said the instructions for the bomb plot came from a Daesh operative based in the Palestinian refugee camp of Ain al-Helwi, who is in touch with extremists in Syria. The terrorist operative was given explosive vests and other weapons to prepare for simultaneous attacks on 3 religious compounds in the southern suburbs of Beirut. This is reminiscent to a wave of attacks in the Beirut suburbs between 2013 and 2014. The instructions were passed to an undercover internal security forces agent who had successfully managed to infiltrate Daesh networks in Lebanon. Observers see that Daesh has lost initiative in Lebanon, Syria and Iraq and is trying to gain ground.
I think that ISIS is now trying to implement a qualitative operation attack in Lebanon after the death of his leader al-Qurashi in 3 February in Syria, because he lost initiative in Lebanon, in Syria, and in Iraq.
Daesh is seemingly taking advantage of a deep financial crisis in Lebanon to attract recruits, promising them high salaries.
ISIS didn't stop trying to get inside the Lebanese society when he succeeded in to send many young men from Tripoli to Iraq. More than 49 young men have been sent to Iraq. 9 of them have been killed, targeted by the Iraqis just 3 weeks ago. And now the information about a Palestinian cell and the Palestinian camp in Lebanon.
Al-Maulawi uncovered that the ministry and the security apparatus are monitoring the movement of Lebanese leaving the northern city of Tripoli to join the terrorist group and have opened talks with Iraqi authorities on this threat. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Hundreds of Afghan youths and sportsmen rallied against the U.S. in Kabul. The rally is part of massive anti-U.S. sentiments underway in the country over the recent decision by the American president to give some parts of the Afghans' national assets to the victims of the 9/11 attacks. "We want all of our money. Biden is a thief. Death to America." These are the slogans that the protesters chanted as they were holding anti-U.S. placards.
These sportsmen call on the U.S. to reverse its decision and free all of their money. They say freezing Afghanistan's assets has harmed all aspects of the Afghan society.
"We have gathered here on behalf of all Afghan youths and sportsmen to condemn the U.S. president's decision to give half of our frozen assets to Americans. Of course, this decision is crazy and unjust. The U.S.'s move has affected all Afghans' lives. Our athletes and sportsmen are quitting their sports due to economic difficulties."
The angry protesters also say that if the U.S. does not reverse its unjust and immoral decision, their protests will escalate.
"The U.S. considers itself as one of the richest countries, but now it's shamelessly stealing from the poorest people of the world. We call on the U.S. to free all of our frozen assets and stop punishing and torturing Afghans. Our demonstrations will continue until we reach our rights."
Staging in front of the U.N. office in Kabul, the protesters called on the U.N. and World Bank donors not to stay silent against the U.S. operations and stay by Afghans' side.
"Afghans were not involved in 9/11 attack. This is crystal clear to the world countries. So why should the U.S. seek revenge from us? In addition, today Afghans are dealing with many economic and health crises. We urge the international community to make the U.S. reconsider its decision and let the flow of aid to our vulnerable people."
Last week, the U.S. president signed an order allowing half of $7 billion in Afghan frozen assets to be given to 9/11 victims. The move has sparked outrage in Afghanistan and was massively denounced. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
This is an occasion to honor poets and poetry. The 16th edition of Fajr International Poetry Festival saw its closing ceremony in Tehran, where the best Persian poetry works of the year were acknowledged and awarded. During the event, participants from Iran and other countries contended in different categories, including classic poetry, modern poetry, and children and young adults.
I won the prize for the best poetry book for children and young adults. My book is titled Silence in the Mother Tongue. I'm so glad that my effort is seen, judged, and acknowledged by top Iranian literary personalities from the jury of the festival.
Certainly, Fajr Poetry Festival is of great significance to me as an Afghan poet. Here, literary experts from Iran, Tajikistan, Afghanistan, and many parts of the world can network and make joint efforts to promote the Persian language.
Iran is known as the land of poets, being home to many world-renowned literary figures over the centuries, including Rumi, Hafez, and Khayyam. Experts here believe Persian poetry has no expiry date, and not only do Iranians still read ancient poems, they're also interested in modern prose and poetry.
Poetry is a beautiful language that speaks the beauty of the world, and such a language always communicates very well with the hearts of human beings. Iranians have long understood the beauty of this language and still listen to it and read it in its every form and genre.
Fajr International Poetry Festival was launched in 2006 as a platform for Persian poets from Iran and other Persian-speaking countries to get together for the elevation of Persian poetry. However, the literary event has grown to encompass non-Persian poets who are interested in Iranian literature.
Poetry holds a special position among Iranians, and you can rarely find an Iranian family that doesn't have a poetry book in their bookshelves. Now, aside from acknowledging Persian literary figures and poets, Fajr Festival seeks to preserve this long-standing culture and introduce it to the world. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Under a sea of red flags, the Democratic Front for the Liberation of Palestine, DFLP, held a big protest to mark its 53rd anniversary and support Al-Quds. People thronged the streets of Gaza City to take part in the event. Protesters shouted slogans against the Israeli regime and vowed to stand with Al-Quds. Tensions heightened across the Palestinian territories in mid-February when Israeli forces and illegal settlers renewed their attacks against Palestinians in Al-Quds' Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood.
53 years on, the DFLP continues to hold sacred the liberation of Al-Quds and the right of return. And we will call on all Palestinians to protect Sheikh Jarrah.
The Democratic Front for the Liberation of Palestine refuses to recognize the Israeli regime and maintains armed resistance as the only way to end the Israeli occupation.
Resistance is the best way to liberate Al-Quds, and we say to our people in Sheikh Jarrah that we always support them. We are willing to sacrifice our lives for the sake of defending Al-Quds and all of Palestine against the Zionist enemy.
DFLP activists called on all Palestinian factions to increase armed resistance against the Israeli regime and its forces. Protesters also slammed Arab countries in the Persian Gulf region for normalizing their relations with Tel Aviv.
All those countries who normalized their ties with Israel are stabbing the Palestinian people in the back and hurting our cause. Israel is using normalization as a pretext to increase its violations in Al-Quds.
Palestinians stress that Al-Quds will always remain the capital of Palestine despite the U.S. and Israeli plots to change its status.
As they mark the 53rd anniversary of the DFLP, Palestinians in Gaza say they will continue to resist the Israeli occupation until the liberation of Al-Quds. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
EU foreign affairs ministers held emergency talks on Tuesday to agree on sanctions against 351 Russian legislators who voted to give independence to two regions in eastern Ukraine. The West claims it's the beginning of an invasion. Russian financial, business and media outlets are also being singled out by the EU.
We agreed to target 27 individuals and entities who are playing a role in undermining or threatening Ukrainian territorial integrity.
The measures will result in asset freezes and travel bans.
We're limiting the Russian government's ability to raise capital on the EU's financial markets.
A new gas pipeline from Russia to Germany will, for now at least, remain closed. This despite the EU desperately needing Russia's energy. Citizens passing by the European Commission, the EU's executive arm, have clearly been following developments closely.
Ukraine, of course, has been generated as a state during the Soviet period, but in a way she's consists of several areas which are very difficult to be maintained together.
Yeah, we need peace. Our economy is based on international trade, and gas is one of our main tools to survive.